I think the fact that one of the first lines that Ta-Nehisi wrote in the Black Panther script was, how can Wakanda be the most technologically advanced nation on the planet, but ruled by the most ancient, you know, sort of system, which is, you know, sort of this dominion, this king ruling the country. And I thought, wow, that's an interesting duality. And that made it really sexy for me.
Ooh-wee, I know y'all got chills. That is the amazingly talented artist and all-around dope guy, Brian Stelfreeze. He's a Black artist who's worked on almost every comic book character you can think of, but we have him here today because he worked alongside Ta-Nehisi Coates on Black Panther, A Nation Under Our Feet.
I think when I describe my art style, I don't tend to describe it in terms of visual. I tend to describe it in terms of what I wish to achieve with it. And I think that sense of duality, that sense of incongruity is what I love displaying on everything that I do.
From Marvel Entertainment and SiriusXM, this is the History of Marvel Comics Black Panther. I'm your host, Nick Stone. And last episode, we got to chop it up with Reginald Hudlin. He made Black Panther the blackest he's ever been, but he also gave us one of the best characters ever, my girl Shuri. However, all is not well in Wakanda when Ta-Nehisi Coates picks up the ball. Let's get into it.
My name is Will Moss. I'm a senior editor at Marvel Comics. And I work on books like Black Panther, of course, and Thor and Hulk.
And in 2015, he was given the opportunity to staff up the creative team for an all-new Black Panther solo series.
The fact that there's a movie coming up definitely didn't hurt things. That got things rolling. But also, it had just been a few years. That's kind of how things will go a lot of the times. If there's a character who has a book, it goes for a while, like with Hudlin's volume. There's like a breather period a little bit. And then once we think that people were, you know, are built up the anticipation for the character to return, that's when we'll bring the character back. So that's what led to us kind of relaunching the Black Panther series back in 2015.
While Marvel went on the hunt for a new writer, the world outside their window was changing by the day. Like, the Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in all 50 states. Hurrah! And for the first time, 90% of Americans had healthcare coverage. There were also some things that weren't so great. Mass shootings, police brutality, and an upcoming election for president were pretty much at the forefront of the American zeitgeist. However, one of the most consistent things about Black Panther is his tendency to appear in times of unrest. And it had been 7 years since his last solo run, but it certainly wasn't the last time he'd appeared in Marvel Comics.
Reggie's run was great, had so many new additions to the mythos, and then all the stuff like after that with the Man Without Fear stuff. Like, there's a lot of cool surprises and twists in his life. And the new volume that, from 2015, we were kind of taking our cue from things that had been done with Panther and Jonathan Hickman's New Avengers run and Secret Wars, because there was a lot of, he was a main character in New Avengers there. And there was a lot of stuff with Wakanda, City of the Dead, and his conflict with Namor. That's where it seemed like we could continue to kind of explore things.
Okay, I'm going to take a second here and give y'all a quick rundown of what happens between Reginald Hudlin's and Ta-Nehisi Coates' runs, because, child, it's a whole lot. Let's get into it. After Hudlin's Panther run, he gives us a Shuri solo series. T'Challa returns badly beaten from a meeting with Namor the Submariner, so Shuri becomes the Black Panther and decides to bring the fight to Atlantis. Bad move, girlfriend. This leads to Doom War, and that's when Dr. Doom reveals it was he who attacked T'Challa, and he plans to take over Wakanda. And he succeeds. Almost. In the middle of all this, our boy T'Challa loses his powers. So in order to stop Doom, he tanks the value of vibranium. Mm-hmm. It saves everyone, but Wakandans are very unhappy. Not only did they lose their king, but Wakanda has been invaded, and when their king returns, he ruins their economy. Then he runs off again, because why not? Oh, and then Jonathan Hickman's New Avengers happens, and Shuri, who is still the Black Panther, dies trying to fight off the Cabal. And then T'Challa comes back as the Black Panther. So, yeah, cool surprises and twists. And can you believe there's actually more stuff in there I didn't talk about? Yeah, it's just a lot, y'all. On a positive note, tackling all this was small potatoes for the man who had just published a number one New York Times bestseller and won a National Book Award.
My name is Ta-Nehisi Coates. I'm a writer. Until relatively recently, I was the writer for Black Panther and Captain America.
In 2015, Mr. Coates was most known for his work at The Atlantic, where he frequently discussed the intersections between race and basically everything. He'd also just published Between the World and Me to wide critical acclaim. So what made Marvel Editorial reach out to a journalist to write a comic? Here's Will again.
He would talk about comics on his Twitter account. Like, we would see him talking about the current books that we were working on. He would be talking about a Mighty Avengers series by Al Ewing that was coming out at the time. And he was, you know, like talking about it like a fan, like a lot of our fans on Twitter talk about the book. So that was something that, you know, really let us know that he had an interest in comics more than just a passing interest. He was actually really into them.
Imagine a Marvel editor sliding into your DMs to offer you a job. What? Okay. It didn't go down just like that, but that's still pretty dope.
I think Between the World and Me either was on its way out or it just come out. It was either Will Moss or Tom Brevoort. I can't remember who reached out to me first, but when I reached out first, asked if I would be interested in writing for Marvel. Didn't say what, but then called up and said, look, we're looking to do Black Panther. Would you be interested in doing it? I was in. I mean, I was in for Marvel. They could have asked me to write anything and I would have done it.
This would be Ta-Nehisi's first time writing comics, so he, like most good writers, did his due diligence.
I read a ton of Priest. I read a ton of Reggie Hudlin. And probably the biggest influence on what I was writing, because he was writing them at the time, was Hickman's. You know, because he was writing an Avengers book, but T'Challa was almost the protagonist. So I spent a lot of time dealing with his T'Challa and thinking about that.
Still, though, learning how to write for a visual medium like comics can be a massive learning curve. Trust me.
It was tough to learn to tell stories through images. That was one of the big, big challenges. There's no guarantee that just because you've had success elsewhere, you were going to have success. You know, comic book writing is a thing. It's an actual thing.
That's where the artist comes in. Will, Ta-Nehisi's editor, knew there'd be a bit of an uphill climb. So he decided to pair Ta-Nehisi with a comics veteran. Combinations do breed success, after all.
Brian is a master. Like, there's comic book artists. Brian's like an artist, you know, who happens to draw comic books. So when it came time to casting Black Panther, I just thought, you know, like, dream artist for this would be Brian Stelfreeze, somebody who can come in and do something that just totally reinvigorated Black Panther and Wakanda. Like, I knew Brian's sense of design, like, that he would bring so much to the table. And so we knew that that was one thing also that we had in mind when we had Ta-Nehisi come on, who hadn't written comics before. We knew that would be a benefit to have somebody like Brian, who was such a skilled storyteller on his own, that it could potentially help make the story stronger because he'd also know about pacing and page breakdowns and things like that.
Having interviewed Brian myself, I can tell you everything Will just said is the tip of the iceberg. He's such a joy to talk to, but I'll let Brian speak for himself.
When Will Moss came to me with Black Panther, my first thought was, no. You know, like he said, yeah, we're going to do a Black Panther series and we'd like you to do the art, compliments, but we can't tell you who the writer's going to be. You know, it was all non-disclosure at that point. And when he said, we can't tell you who the writer's going to be, I said, well, then I'm out. No, I'm not going to do the project. If I'm going to do Black Panther, it's got to be an awesome Black Panther.
And that's because Mr. Stelfreeze had his own unique relationship with the character.
I feel I got one of the best introductions to the character because I remember picking up an Avengers issue and seeing Black Panther and kind of going, oh man, who's this character? This character is really cool. And Black Panther was stalking around in these alleyways and doing all this cool stuff. And I really liked the look of the character. But then later, when the character was with the Avengers, he took off his mask and it was a black guy. And I was just like, whoa! So that like really got me enamored with the character because I fell in love with the character before I realized the character's ethnicity. So it was like, I think, really authentic for me.
Wild, right? So when Will approached Brian for the series, Brian wanted to make sure the story would live up to the character he'd fallen in love with.
I'm not going to do this character that I love and it's awesome, but do a terrible story with this character. So it's better for me to walk away from it. And then Will kind of went, no, this is something that's going to be really cool. And I'm like, dude, if I don't know the writer, you know, I can't agree to it. And he said, well, what if I sent you the plot? And I was just like, well, okay. And he sent me the plot and I read the plot and I was just like, whoa, this is really interesting.
The pitch was almost exactly what made it to print. Wakandans at odds with the ruling class, civil servants deserting their stations, and a king who really didn't want the throne.
He had the first year mapped out. What you saw in comics was pretty much right there in the pitch. Like, he had an act structure all broken down. Like, he knew what he wanted to do in it. We had some stuff we went back and forth with him about, but for the most part, it was all there.
Which is pretty impressive. Y'all just heard me go over what happened after Hudlin's run, and that is a lot to encapsulate in an all-new pitch for a very new comic writer.
There was a little space between me and him. There were a couple of people who did, like, kind of smaller runs. A lot of what I was doing definitely dealt with, you know, much of what had happened.
As a career journalist, Ta-Nehisi knew the thread he wanted to weave between events like Doom War to the conflicts in everyday Wakandan life. Here he is again.
When you think about monarchy, it literally meant a nation of people who are underfoot, a nation of people who don't necessarily decide what direction their government takes. I was just really interested. I was really interested in their private lives, and I thought that was a good place to be.
And Brian did too, because after he read the pitch...
So that's when I called back and I said, okay, yeah, let's do this. And then, like, after everything got signed, he said, oh, and by the way, the writer is Ta-Nehisi Coates. And I was just like, what? Of course I'm thinking, you are such an idiot. You know, you are going to turn this thing down. So it was, like, really cool that I feel that I was at the perfect place in my career at the perfect time to handle the character. And even my political awareness really wasn't there early in my career. So if I was even asked to do the character early in my career, I would have done the character a disservice. But now, me being an older person, a much more aware person, it was just the perfect time for me to jump on the character.
So we've got these two juggernauts of industry, one from journalism, the other from comics, working together on a Black Panther story that would turn Wakanda on its head. But before Ta-Nehisi could get started, Brian needed to do one more thing.
When everything was finalized, all the contracts and everything were signed, I said the worst thing an artist can say, which is, no, I'm not going to start on it. I'm going to take a few weeks, maybe even a month, to just think about Wakanda. I'm not going to draw page one. I'm going to think about what makes Wakanda work. Because in my mind, there's this thing that happens. Like, if I say Paris, a picture comes into your head. If I say Sydney, Australia, a picture comes into your head. New York City, every city that you can mention, there's this image of how that city looks or how that city feels. Your average person, if you say Johannesburg, can't think of a single building in Johannesburg, but they know the feel of it. So one of the things that I wanted to do, because that didn't exist with Wakanda, my thing was, let's figure out how Wakanda looks. Let's figure out how it looks, how it feels. So when a person says Wakanda, that isn't like a placeholder. That's an actual thing that happens. And that's when I started digging into the technological side of things.
And honestly, who hasn't asked themselves about vibranium and how it actually works?
At one point, he said, hey, man, I don't know tech.
Brian is referring to Ta-Nehisi here, by the way.
He's like, I don't do tech. I don't do all that stuff. Here's my lane. And of course, I kind of went, well, I love tech. I don't do politics. You know. So he was just like, well, how does the technology of Wakanda work? And I did this sort of thing of the evolution of technology in Wakanda. You know, I've got like a bunch of buddies that work at Texas A&M and MIT, and I was talking to them about, okay, how does vibranium work? And that's when I kind of came across the idea of like, well, vibranium, rather than it being this thing that absorbs kinetic energy, wouldn't it be better if it was a battery that could absorb one form of energy and return another? I told Ta-Nehisi that you can punch it, but then it can be converted to electricity. You can punch it, then it can power a laptop. And then you can redistribute it as kinetic energy. And Ta-Nehisi said, but what if he redistributed all at once? So the whole Panther pulse, you know, is kind of going, here's a bit of technology, and him looking at that technology and going, well, here's what you can do with that technology. So it was like really cool that here's this small thing that I came up with. And then this creative genius comes in and says, well, here's something else that you didn't think about that you could do with this technology.
As we know, vibranium is one of the strongest resources in the Marvel Universe. But Brian wanted to give more meaning to the celestial metal. It's not just a power source or a money magnet. It's actually a way to bond Wakandans.
And one of the things that I thought was important, especially when you consider the African diaspora, and I thought it was a great metaphor for us to say that vibranium wasn't only just this rock that's in Wakanda, but there's vibranium in the atmosphere, there's vibranium in the soil, there's vibranium in the plants. And every time someone from Wakanda leaves Wakanda, just like we all have copper and iron in our blood, Wakandans have vibranium in their blood. You know, so that connects them to the mother, that vibranium that's always there. It really kind of personifies this connection to each other that all Africans feel, and this connection to the mother, that no matter how far the diaspora spreads, we're still all connected in some way.
Now can y'all see why Will wanted Brian Stelfreeze on this book? Anyway, on April 6th, 2016, Black Panther Volume 6, Number 1, A Nation Under Our Feet, hit the stands and we meet T'Challa at the lowest of the low. After returning to Wakanda for the umpteenth time, he takes the throne again as Black Panther, but not as a crowd favorite. The Wakandans have had it with their wayward royal. They call Homeboy the Orphan King. Here's Ta-Nehisi again.
When I read about him, he was always leaving Wakanda. He was always going somewhere else. Like, that was a constant thing with T'Challa. He went away for college. He was going away to be an adventurer, all of this. And part of the rebellion, and even before that, part of, you know, his beef with Shuri was the fact that he hadn't really been around. And so I thought that was interesting. I was wondering what he was pursuing. And so I had this idea that maybe he had been tagged with being a monarch, but maybe really didn't want to be one.
Even though T'Challa has always been larger than life, this is the most human we've ever seen him. If I'm being frank, he's a little insecure at this point. He'd rather be a hero or a scientist than a king. He believes Shuri is a better ruler, and he just can't seem to get anything right. T'Challa doesn't have all the answers. And the sooner he learns that, the sooner things start to look up. But we know our boy T'Challa is a little hard-headed.
It's such a nice way to like humanize him and make him feel relatable, because in a lot of ways, it's tough to relate to this guy who's like this. Because like Black Panther, one of the main things he's known for, like, and Priest's really kind of cemented this, is being the smartest person in the room, the guy who has everything figured out, the guy who's never shows his cards. He's just a really smart, cool guy that you don't know really what's going on, which makes him kind of even that much more intimidating and cool. But so when Ta-Nehisi came in and kind of really got into T'Challa's head, that was such a nice change of pace, because you always do kind of wonder, who is this guy? Like, you want to know more about him. Obviously, there have been lots of writers who've done great work getting into who T'Challa is as a character, but it really felt fresh to have Ta-Nehisi come in and explore T'Challa as he did, to show that he's got doubts, to show just how he feels as this ruler of this weight on his head, and even as a superhero.
But how do you show that vulnerability in character design? Well, that's where Brian comes in.
And that's when I figured out how I was going to even draw the character. And really, my main inspiration for that came from looking at Kirby because I figured, well, let me go back to the source and let me draw as much as I can from that. And then after looking at Kirby, one of the things that I liked about T'Challa was the fact that he was not human to a certain extent. I mean, this guy is a world leader level guy, absolutely brilliant, but he's also a king. So I thought, well, I need to do something that makes him look unhuman. And that's when I actually started to study Michelangelo, and I started to study a lot of the Renaissance sculptures. So my idea was, or was to make him an ideal. So when you look through the book, I decided to draw Black Panther and T'Challa as a sculpture, but everyone else is human. Everyone else is a little bit more organic, and Shuri is about halfway. You know, so all the sort of bevels on his face and everything were to basically make you kind of go, wow, I'm looking at a piece of like obelisk. I'm looking at like obsidian shards of a person, you know. And once I got that down, I was just like, okay, I know this place. I know these people. Now I'm not being creative. I'm just doing portraiture. And that changes my entire approach to doing the art.
I know this sounds like a good thing. T'Challa was blessed by the Panther God and is sculpted in her image. He's supposed to be perfect. But that's his fatal flaw. Looking or even presenting as more than human is actually detrimental to his status as a leader of the people, because they need someone who can relate to them. But Brian didn't stop there.
And I think it's because of that month that I took aside to create Wakanda as, to a certain extent, a character, that we started kind of going, oh, wait a minute. This is not just Black Panther, Shuri. This is something else. A lot of these characters are playing service to something bigger, and that bigger thing is Wakanda.
And if these people are serving Wakanda, they all have different ideas of what the country needs. After all, their economy's been trashed, their land invaded and attacked, and their queen's been killed in battle. So, fine, their king has returned, but the people of Wakanda will not be silenced when it comes to what they want. Basically, Wakanda's mess is on blast for everyone to see. Starting with the Dora Milaje, here's Ta-Nehisi.
I always thought the place of the Dora Milaje were very interesting in Wakanda. And I thought it was interesting that in this advanced society, you had this model of women as bodyguards and just how they had been attired and everything. And I was just very interested in their own lives. I was very interested in how they felt.
In Coates' run, two Dora, Ayo and Anika, question their loyalty to the throne after Anika is taken into custody for killing a village chief. This is a guy whose violence against women went unchecked in T'Challa's absence. So homegirl felt like she was just doing her due diligence.
I think one of the places where it rang home was this one scene of female trafficking that Ta-Nehisi did. And when I read this scene, it just really hit me, you know? And I'm like, wow, this is happening in this perfect place. And one of the things that I did with that was in my research of Africa, I found these baobab trees, and they're considered the tree of life, you know? And these trees are like thousands of years old. It takes forever, but these trees are capable of feeding villages. These trees are capable of taking people through droughts and the harshest of times. And I thought, what a desecration would it be to have these cages in the tree of life? You know, what an insult to this tree to do this. And again, what an insult to women to do this to them. So I wanted to reflect that duality again in the setting. So the first picture you see is that shot, that African shot of the baobab trees. But if you look a little closer, you know, this isn't perfect. This isn't a picturesque African scene. This is horrible.
Incidents like these cause Ayo, Anika, and several other Dora Milaje to leave the Order. They become Midnight Angels and start the No One faction. No One is short for No One Man, which refers to their gripe with the monarchy having all the deciding power in Wakanda. Here's Will Moss.
I love how he introduced Aoa and Anika, them kind of deciding on their own what it meant to serve Wakanda and what that meant and what their obligation was to T'Challa and to the throne and to the people and to themselves and to their community. I also think that, you know, like that first year, just the whole under nation under our feet is just a great story that has a lot of meat on the bones in terms of stuff to think about, in terms of how societies run, in terms of what monarchies are, in terms of all that stuff. But it managed to also be this really exciting action story.
At the same time, there's the people, a terrorist group led by Tetu the Sorcerer and a revealer named Zinzi. To make it simple, they want to overthrow the royal family by any means necessary.
The basic idea was that they were supposed to represent a radicalized democratic element. And the notion was to get T'Challa, you know, to the point where even if he didn't approve of their means, he could see something about and something in who they were.
Zinzi's powers as a revealer allowed her to amplify the frustration, anger, dread, and general disdain the Wakandan public had with their head of state. And like I said before, they had hella beef.
When you look at Wakanda, there's perfection. Everything is absolutely technologically advanced and so beautiful. But when you look a little closer, it's ugly. You know, when you look at the way that women are being treated, when you look at the way the workers, the miners are being treated, when you look at all this rebellion that's happening, you realize, no, it's only perfect for the people at the top. The people out of power, it's not so perfect for them. And the more lower down on that perceived scale that I drew people, the more organic I wanted them to look, the more rounded, the more brutal I wanted their appearance to be.
This goes back to Brian's motivation to draw T'Challa like a sculpture. When compared to his countrymen, they look pedestrian, common, hashtag basic. That type of disparity can't last forever, though. To make matters worse, the ruler they really want, Shuri, is still trapped in a living death. But not for long. Here's editor Will Moss again.
He was really keen on Ron bringing Shuri back. Obviously, like, that was the cliffhanger of the first issue, because Shuri was dead at the time. She died during Jonathan Hickman's run on New Avengers. And so he not only wanted to bring her back, he wanted to give her a whole new personality, a whole new power set. Like, he really wanted to not just have Shuri come back. He wanted to have Shuri come back and be her own character. Like, that was, she'd been Black Panther, right? Like, that was a bit of a challenge, was if T'Challa's Black Panther again, how does Shuri not feel just in the way, or like, she's already been Black Panther, what does she do next?
One of the most salient themes in Ta-Nehisi's run is how the past informs the present and shapes the progress of the future. Shuri is the key to that evolution. So in order to emphasize this idea, Ta-Nehisi created the T'Challia.
It's memory. It's the idea of Wakanda and memory. And, you know, I thought that a lot of the basis of what Wakanda was covered. And I was more interested in its historical memory. And the T'Challia is supposed to represent that.
In her stasis, Shuri's soul is led into the T'Challia by a griot spirit. And she's taken through the history of Wakanda. Turmoil is an inevitable part of growth for any country, and Wakanda is no exception. And after Shuri's soul is rescued by T'Challa, her powers are used as another way to showcase memory in the series. She comes out the other side of the T'Challia as the Aja Adana. Here's Will Moss again.
So Ta-Nehisi came up with just a really awesome idea for what to do with Shuri when he brought her back, making her the ancient future and having access to all the myths and history of Wakanda, like to bring in powers that Wakandans have passed down through myth.
Shuri's enlightenment allows her to become the linchpin in the struggle for power in Wakanda. Not only does she facilitate a truce between the Midnight Angels and the Black Panther, who then join forces to fight against the people, she drops one of the most important bars in the whole series. For in the end, it is only the story that matters. In Wakanda's case, it's the story a nation chooses to tell itself. Since its inception, Wakanda has always been portrayed as the ideal of perfection. A rich, thriving, uncolonized, technologically advanced utopia living under a monarchy. But Ta-Nehisi poked holes in that myth. And by the end of the arc, T'Challa makes Wakanda a democracy with representatives from the Midnight Angels, the people, yes, the terrorist group, turns out they'd been under a spell, and all the other tribes of the country.
When the first call I had with him, like, he said, like, what if Wakanda became a democracy? And, you know, that was just like, it was like, oh, man, like that was just, I could see right there all the possibilities for where he could go. And it was just this very smart and dramatic and invigorating story for Black Panther and Wakanda.
Ta-Nehisi's A Nation Under Our Feet was nothing short of a hit. The first issue sold over 300,000 copies and received critical acclaim in Entertainment Weekly and from NPR.
People who were into it, like the numbers on our orders on the first issue were crazy high. And like, we got all kinds of fan letters to start. We had a really active letters page. People were very into the book. People felt very passionate about T'Challa and Shuri and everything like that. And they received what Ta-Nehisi was doing with them really positively. We heard from a lot of people who were trying comics for the first time because Ta-Nehisi was writing it. And we heard from people from all ages, old readers and kids too. We get, you know, kids that I guess maybe underestimate kids, but like there were kids that were reading the run and following every, you know, new issue and new complicated, you know, political maneuverings. Like they were all about it. And I was like, always impressed with that.
Brian Stelfreeze felt the love from fans firsthand when he appeared at conventions and artist lectures.
And I was talking to a buddy of mine, Cully Hamner, and Cully said, dude, this is going to be important. You know, and it's weird to have that word associated with the work that you're doing. And I kind of blew him off and kind of went, yeah. You know, and I did the work as a comic book creator. You do the work in a biosphere. You do the work at home, you know, alone, and you're just doing it. And no one's kind of seeing the work as you're producing it. And it's just really blowing my mind to see going to Spain and going to Africa and going to all these places and seeing the influence of the book and the character. And it really kind of blew my mind because it still felt like I was doing a comic book. I mean, I was really enjoying it. I was having a fantastic time doing it, but ultimately doing a comic book. I think ultimately the Black person, the diaspora, the African diaspora, our place in this world, I think the strength of us doesn't come from our ability to assimilate. I think the strength of us comes from our ability to terraform, comes from our ability to get into a culture and that, rather than us becoming that culture becomes us. Everything that's American now, the food, the music, everything, that's us. And it's really awesome to feel like a contributor to the terraforming of the world.
Terraforming, the process of creating an environment that can sustain life, aka making a world that people actually want to live in. And even though Brian is speaking on a global scale, he and Ta-Nehisi also managed to terraform the world of Wakanda through their unique fusion of storytelling methods. But terraforming doesn't just stop at your own work. It's also bringing other people into the fold as well. Here's Will Moss.
Something else that was really great about Ta-Nehisi's time in the book is how he brought in other writers that were new to Marvel to kind of further explore and flesh out the world of Black Panther. Like with World of Wakanda book, for example, like that was, he had Roxane Gay, he put us in touch with her and she wrote that wonderful story for Ayo Anika. And Giona Harvey, who he co-wrote Black Panther and the Crew with. It was terrific that he wasn't just fleshing out like, you know, the world of Black Panther within the title of Black Panther, but he went beyond that and brought in new voices. through these other titles, explored different aspects of the character and the world around them.
In fact, he gave a friend of ours the opportunity to update Black Panther's origin story.
As best I remember it, it started with a text from Ta-Nehisi Coates, and he was like, Marvel is interested in you writing a Black Panther project. And I was like, really? I was definitely shocked. This came out of the blue. There was no like pretext. I didn't send in a pitch or anything like that.
That should be a familiar voice if you've been paying attention. Welcome back to Evan Narciss. He was a commentator on episode 3, but now he's here as the writer of a very special Black Panther miniseries.
As it turns out, Will Moss had read some of my stuff, some of my articles and essays I'd written about the Black Panther over the years. And, you know, as Ta-Nehisi told it to me, he's like, you know, Will was impressed with my love and knowledge of the character and wanted to know if I wanted to write a Black Panther series.
In 2017, Marvel asked Evan to write, or rather update, Black Panther's origin story in a limited series. It was titled Rise of the Black Panther, and it would incorporate all the lore from 1966 to 2018 in a single 6-issue run. Now keep in mind, that was 52 years of comics to consider while Ta-Nehisi was still knee-deep in his series. I decided to chat with Evan about how he terraformed Black Panther's past and how his series would lay the groundwork for more storytellers to expand the world of Wakanda. Let's have a listen.
So one of the things I wanted to do with Rise of the Black Panther was kind of tackle this metaphorical question of what do we do with what we inherit, right? Me as a writer, coming after all these writers who I've loved, who've touched this character, Priest, McGregor, Dwayne McDuffie wrote some Black Panther and the Fantastic Four, and Ta-Nehisi, of course. Now it's my turn to step into like this stream of history, the same way that T'Challa does. One of the goals I set for myself in writing this series was trying to honor as many of the stories that preceded me as possible and really trying not to invalidate or retcon anything. One of the things that makes Marvel's superhero continuity really unique is they rarely kind of reboot their continuity. You're kind of supposed to understand that everything happened. So that's the way I approached it.
So how did you reconcile what you wanted to bring to the established canon with what Coates was already doing?
Ta-Nehisi was a consultant on the series, and we did talk a little bit. Mostly, he let me do my thing. But one of the kind of thematic concerns of Ta-Nehisi's run that I wanted to pick up on was T'Challa's reluctance at having to be king, but also this idea that he has drives and wants that are in conflict with his responsibility as king, you know? And this is something that precedes Ta-Nehisi, but he did make it a major concern during his run. The fact that he loves science and wants to explore and has a wanderlust powered by those desires that pulls him out of Wakanda, you know? In Rise of the Black Panther, I want to show like, okay, what is it that fuels that in him? And also, you know, his family, Ramonda, was such an important part of Ta-Nehisi's run, but, you know, she's not his birth mother. She did raise him, but in the continuity, there is this character of Inyami, who's his biological mother. And the older stories always said that she died during childbirth. And I want to explore who she was. I was like, well, we've never seen T'Chaka as a scientist, right? We've never seen him as the dude in the lab. Where does T'Challa get that proclivity from? I drew from my own life when I was thinking about that because my daughter loves to read. And I know she loves to read because of me. And I was like, well, you know, what if T'Challa got his love of science from his mom, who was really a scientist?
I just have to say, like, I love what you did with Inyami simply because she is such an excellent predecessor for Shuri, right? So, like, you have this woman who obviously is no longer alive, but you gave Shuri somebody to look up to. So, like, shout out to you from me and my favorite character who is thankful that there was a woman scientist for her to be like, yeah, she did that, so I can do it too. Shout out. So, interesting thing, though, like, your story, like, we find out that it wasn't the Fantastic Four. They weren't the first Americans to make any kind of Wakandan contact, right? So Captain America comes in. I remember reading the opening pages of issue number one and being like, boop! Like on page one, you have Azuri being like, oh, so you came to steal everything, like what you do on the rest of the continent. I was like, oh, snap, we're really jumping in here on 100.
why Captain America, right? So like, we know it wasn't Claw. We know it wasn't the Fantastic Four. You establish that Captain America was the first person to come through. And then of course they join forces because of the Nazis, but why Captain America?
My goal with revisiting that story was thinking about the political ramifications of that moment of first contact. You know, Priest kind of explored it a little bit from a smaller frame of like arbitrage between Steve Rogers and Azuri. Steve wants vibranium because of the American war effort. And it was T'Chaka in that story before the kind of timeline rolled back a little bit. But he was like, "What? Why should I trust you? Who are you?" And so when I revisited that, you know, I wanted to, again, evoke the actual real world history of what happened on the African continent in terms of the kind of pillaging and exploitation of resources. You know, one of the things that Ta-Nehisi and I talked about all the time was like, okay, if this country is a real country with real history that has chosen to secret itself away from the world, it must mean actually that they know what else has happened around them, right? So that's the kind of history that Azuri is invoking in that first issue of The Rise of the Black Panther. And then I want to show, okay, he gives Steve some vibranium. This is not going to be a secret. And I want to show that there were a little bit of a political controversy that when T'Chaka becomes a grown man, he's still hearing about it. He's like, "Oh, your dad never should give him that white dude with the stars and stripes some of our vibranium." But he's like, "It turned out okay, right?" You know, but that's one of the starts of the threads that runs throughout the book, which is they're not going to be able to hide forever, right? And if Steve Rogers and Hydra got there, other people are going to get there. So it's the kind of the history of what encroachment and interventionism means to a country like Wakanda and how the people who are the Black Panther and other characters have to respond to it.
I love it. You also bring us a little Killmonger action. So T'Challa goes to the United Nations and he brings Eric back to Wakanda. What was it like getting into Killmonger's head?
It was great. Again, I went back to the source material, the original appearances of Killmonger in Jungle Action, written by Don McGregor. And what's wild is he's in exile. We don't quite know why. It's clear he like displeased T'Challa in some way, but he asked to come back home to Wakanda, and T'Challa's like, "Okay, get on this plane." And I'm like, "Really?" Again, in the kind of different pacing and creative modes of the way older comics were done, is like introduce him quickly, get him involved, set him up as the antagonist. And you know, his complaints with T'Challa in those older stories were that he wasn't running the country right. And that's been a hallmark of the character ever since. He thinks he can do it better. But I want to explore, like, well, why does he think this way, you know? And what does it mean for a dude who grew up outside of this near utopia to really be disconnected with the life he could have had there and the culture that he was supposed to grow up in? He fetishizes it. He tries to weaponize this memory of Wakanda in a way that puts him in direct odds with T'Challa. One of the things I always chalk up to this kind of cosmic coincidence is that kind of impetus of you have a Wakandan who grew up outside of Wakanda and, you know, wasn't connected to the country's like kind of glorious history and achievements. And Killmonger represents that. Killmonger represents, okay, I'm cut off from my history. I only know some of it. And that, again, is a wound that turns into antagonism in his case. Again, I think all these characters in Rise of the Black Panther grapple with history, you know, in the ways that affects them personally and kind of institutionally. And Killmonger is one of the best examples of that.
Yeah, and like what I love about the way that you write this world and these people is that it gives it kind of a parable vibe. There are these object lessons, honestly, if you're willing to read it that closely. After writing in this world about these characters, what are your overall thoughts on Wakanda and its people?
I think Wakanda is such a great fictional construct because even though it doesn't exist in the real world, I think the ethos, the mindset that powers Wakanda as a fictional construct is real, which is Black people all around the world exist in systems and structures that were purposely built to deny them opportunity or leave them on the fringes of society. But those same Black people over the world, over the generations and centuries, have fought those systems and managed to survive and thrive and achieve in spite of the forces that are deployed against them. Wakanda represents that, you know? So that's part of it. And, you know, down to the individual characters, again, it's all about your relationship with history. You know, T'Challa knows he has to be king. Despite whatever personal feelings he might have about that, he's going to fulfill that duty to the best of his ability. And it always costs him something. Personal relationships, his own bodily health and well-being, you know, he always pays a price. And the characters around him push and pull against those tensions, you know? So I think the Black Panther as a character is just such a great vehicle to explore Black history, Black achievement, the responsibility, belonging to a community and representing a community. He lets you do all those things. And I think that's one of the things that's like really, frankly, kind of poetic and lyrical about the character.
The way that you dig into this stuff is fascinating and awesome. As a journalist, because I do think that you being a journalist, having a journalist background, has something to do with your ability to really dig in and get down to the brass tacks and the humanity of these characters. Ta-Nehisi is also a journalist. What do you think the two of you were able to bring to the storytelling as journalists?
One of the functions of journalism is to speak truth to power, right? Your experience as an individual moving through the world where laws and social programming and traditions affect you a certain way. When you're a journalist, you interrogate all of that. And you bring that curiosity and impulse into a fictional construct like the Marvel Universe. And it's like, yo, what if everybody in Wakanda was upset that they've been conquered and all this damage has been done? You know, that's kind of the inciting incident of Ta-Nehisi's run. It's like there's unrest in the country because the national myth they've been telling themselves about themselves has been proven to be not as sturdy as they thought. You know, insurrection happens during T'Challa's reign. And for me, it was like, okay, well, we never really saw the moment in great detail that Wakanda revealed itself to the world. There are older stories where this was like mentioned in passing, but like, really, how does the world react to this new nation on the African continent showing off all their capabilities? And I think there is like a journalistic impulse that probably fuels both of our approaches to the character.
Which I love, right? Like, my favorite thing about both what Coates did and what you did is that it clouds the fantasy a little bit, which makes us kind of put our feet on the ground. You know, like, okay, this is where we are. There's chaos everywhere. There's no escaping the chaos. How do we interact and move through it? So shout out to you and to him for that, because I personally appreciate it a lot. How does it feel to be a part of Black Panther's lore and legacy?
I always say it's surreal. You know, it's so surreal that something I wrote, something I did, contributes to the kind of like metaphorical power of Black Panther, this character who I've always loved. It's like, yeah, I got to talk about his mama, you know? I got to show how his parents fell in love. And, you know, that's all, a lot of that stuff comes from deeply personal motivations on my part. You know, I was raised by a single mom and I was like, let's show her, you know, let's show his mom. And I come from an immigrant background. So one of the reasons I really loved T'Challa early on was that he was kind of like an immigrant superhero, you know? Like, he was rolling with the Avengers and talking about how much he missed his home. And that reminded me of my parents, my mother specifically, how she talked about missing Haiti. So, you know, I used that as fuel for the storytelling. And, like, the fact that, like, I got to do it and people responded to it, it's part of the lore and the history that now surrounds the character. And I got to honor the work of the storytellers that came before me, who I loved. And I wouldn't have a career as a writer if not for reading comics and reading Black Panther comics. So the fact that I got to do all of that still blows me away.
That's a whole word. So, okay, my final question is, what did you think of Ta-Nehisi's final arc, The Intergalactic Empire of Wakanda?
Oh, man, it's just an amazing kind of inversion of so many of the things you take for granted with a Black Panther story. People always talk about, well, he's different because he's a king. Well, what if he's not a king? What if he's a slave? He's different because he has access to all this technology. Well, what if he's on the run all the time? And his enemies that he has to fight actually have outpaced him technologically. You know, he doesn't have access to all the stuff that he could do in a lab. Takes all these things. Well, it's different because, you know, he was chosen by Bast. Well, what if Bast put her favor on somebody else? What if she decided that somebody else was a better embodiment of Wakandan ideals and ambitions? So it takes all these things and turns them on their ears And I think it's great. I also have a soft spot for that storyline because Ta-Nehisi is using the real world Haitian Revolution as inspiration for the slave rebellion that T'Challa becomes part of. And I'm Haitian, my parents are Haitian, and I love it being used metaphorically like that. By the time that storyline ends, all these amazing Black heroes and characters from the Marvel Universe are in Wakanda making a last stand. And one of the things that Ta-Nehisi does in that storyline is he turns Wakanda kind of into like a spiritual homeland for all these characters. He's like, you're all Wakandan. Like, you represent what we're trying to represent and do. And I love that. As a place to end his run, I think it's really beautiful.
Yes, and amen. So many mic drops in this episode, y'all. Ta-Nehisi wrote Black Panther for 5 years, but his contribution to the galaxy of Wakanda will last forever. Wakanda was always bigger than just T'Challa. And Ta-Nehisi made sure to emphasize that by bringing in more voices. He brought in writers like Evan Narcisse, Roxane Gay, Yona Harvey to do their own takes on the interior lives of the people of Wakanda. And of course, how those people felt about their king. Now, I will say, at the end of Ta-Nehisi's run, our boy T'Challa, he ain't happy. He's not only a king, but an emperor. And that's even more responsibility. For all that hardship, you'd think we'd end on a more hopeful note. But not quite.
Well, because when he made it a democracy, the idea was that he was sort of phasing himself out as the guy, the one man. And he ends up ultimately, you know, responsible for even more. But there was always a sense that he couldn't get out of this. I think it ended at just really banging that point home.
Sheesh. With that kind of ending, I had to wonder, how did Ta-Nehisi feel after finishing his time with the Black Panther?
It was a lot of fun. I would just sit with my notebook and I would just, you know, write things out and try to figure out what would be cool to see, what could happen with T'Challa. It just was a blast. I had a great time. I enjoyed my time. I look forward to seeing what the next person does.
And on that note, in the next and final episode of The History of Marvel Comics Black Panther, yes, it's sad, I know, but we'll get to talk to the man writing Black Panther today, Academy Award-winning screenwriter John Ridley. We've also got a roundtable with some friends we've made along the way. You don't want to miss it. Ready to blast off into the intergalactic empire of Wakanda? Check the show notes for a link to Ta-Nehisi Coates' run on Marvel Unlimited. The History of Marvel Comics Black Panther is a co-production of Marvel Entertainment and SiriusXM. Black Panther was created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. This episode is produced by Alexis Williams with help from Jasmine Estrada, M.R. Daniel, Isabel Robertson, and Tyree Rush. The creative producer is Harry Goh. The development manager is Brad Barton. The production manager is Larissa Rosen. And the consulting editor is Cece Pascal. The fact checker is Natalie Mead. This episode was mixed by Matthias Winter, and the theme music is written and performed by Black Violin. Executive producers are Jill Duboff and Stephen Wacker. Special thanks to Dan Buckley, Daniel Fink, Ricky Purden, Joe Quesada, Ron Richards, and Sarah Amos. Listen anytime with new Marvel episodes releasing weekly. Hear it first exclusively by subscribing to Marvel Podcasts Unlimited on Apple Podcasts or on the SXM app. And coming soon, everywhere.